And Merry Christmas now to those of you in the Mountain Time Zone. We've already had Christmas in the Central and Eastern Time Zones, and we'll wish one more in the Western Time Zone next hour, of course. Good to be with you, and we'll be doing the same thing on New Year's Eve as well. Up next, Dr. Knowledge joins us, Charles Richbloom, as we talk about some fascinating facts about Christmas next on Coast to Coast AM.
This is Ouija board expert Karen Dahlman, and I usually spend my Christmas Eve with family and friends, and of course, listening to Coast AM.
And welcome back to Coast. Hello, Karen. Happy Christmas. Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year upcoming. Charles Richbloom back with us. Charles, nicknamed Dr. Knowledge, has built one of the largest collections in the world of fascinating facts and stories that serve as a source for his knowledge in a nutshell book series. Charles served as a news and sports director for a station in Pittsburgh, taught some college journalism, founded a news service as well, and here he is, one of his books, all-time book of fascinating facts. Charles, welcome back. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, George, and it's wonderful that you're working here on Christmas Day. That's great.
It's a little promise we made to the audience a long time ago, Charles, and we're going to do the same thing on Christmas night and New Year's Eve and night, and we just keep doing it. No tapes on this show.
That's very nice. That's good to hear, and Merry Christmas to all your listeners out there.
So how have you been?
Just fine, thanks, and happy to be back with you on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. We have a couple hours of some fun facts and tidbits and things like that, but tell us how you amassed all these fascinating facts.
Well, I was an intern at a radio station in my hometown of Pittsburgh when I was a teenager, and my job, we didn't have computers, of course, you know, that's many years ago. And we didn't have computers, we had teletypes, and the news came over teletypes, and my job was, of all the interns, was just to tear off the papers the news stories came over and put them up on a nail up on the wall. You put news one place, sports another place, business news another place, features another place, and so on. Anyhow, they had me where I was the youngest one there, so they had me working on July 4th. And a story came over the teletype, a feature story from the Associated Press, that three of the first five U.S. presidents all died on July 4th. And I thought, boy, that's an amazing fact.
Mm-hmm.
I remember learning that in school. And I looked it up, and it is true. Three of the first five U.S. presidents did indeed all die on July 4th. You know, the fact that they all died on the same date is amazing. And the fact that that date was July 4th... and all of unrelated causes, by the way. Just very quickly, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died, second and third presidents, both died on July 4th, 1826. And the fifth president, James Monroe, died on July 4th, 1831. So anyhow, I said, boy, that's amazing. So I wrote that down, and I just started started collecting things like that, looking for things like that, and that's how it all started.
Did you have a big folder of wire stories all stashed together?
Yeah, and of course, again, in those days, we didn't have computers, so it was
that's
all
right.
Scraps of paper.
Yep.
times have changed.
They sure have. Oh, my gosh. That's the one thing that computers have done and done very well for us in this business.
Yeah.
They've made things so concise and packaged. You don't have to have papers spread all over the place like you used to. I used to have magazine articles, newspaper articles,
right.
Clippings, and like you say, the wires. And
right. I got to clean out. In fact, my son keeps telling me, clean out your files. And I have about 10 files here, and there's yellow paper that goes back 50 years. And I hate to throw it away, but I'm probably going to have to. Anyhow, what I did, George, was in the last year or so, I just took what I considered the best of everything I had and put it in this new book I have, the all-time book of fascinating facts, and we have that book now, and so I can probably throw the old papers away.
I bet you won't. It's got too much nostalgia there.
That's what my son says. I think you probably are right.
Put it in a box and take it to storage or something like that. Let's talk about a little Christmas facts and tidbits, of course, and what are some of your favorite things about Christmas, Charles, that are strange?
Well, one thing, I noticed you played a song about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer a little while ago. It's an interesting story. It's an amazing story how Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer came to be. Originally, it was not a song. There was an advertising director of a department store in Chicago. His name was Robert May. And in the late 1930s, he wrote this poem about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It wasn't a song, as I say. And what he did with it, he used it as a giveaway at the store and also used it as a newspaper ad. It was just a poem about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It was like 1938. 10 years later, 1948, his brother-in-law was a man named Johnny Marks, who was a songwriter. And he saw the poem that Robert May had written about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and so he put music to it. And then tried to get somebody to record it, and he took it around to all, he was from Los Angeles, he took it all around the artists he knew. Nobody wanted to record it. Nobody was interested in it. And he spent about 6 months trying to get somebody to record the words and the song he had written about Rudolph. Finally, in desperation, he was an old friend of Gene Autry's.
Oh, great.
And Gene Autry, as a favor, Johnny Marks said, geez, I've been trying to get this recorded for so long. So Gene Autry said, okay, and he did it as a favor. He said, I'll put it on the flip side of the next record I have coming out. And he did. He put it on the flip side. And to everybody's surprise, it became one of the biggest hits in music history. And, it's just amazing. Had he not been friendly with Gene Autry, we might never have heard
that
song.
What was the song on the other side?
That I don't know.
Nobody remembers that. They just remember Rudolph.
Everybody forgot that song, and they remember. So, yeah, we have that story in the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. One other little fact about that story is, originally, Robert May was going to call the reindeer Rollo. He wrote it originally as Rollo, the red-nosed reindeer. And he had a four-year-old daughter who said, I think Rudolph, she came up with the name Rudolph. She said, I like Rudolph better than Rollo.
And out of the mouth of babes, huh?
Yeah, and it was really her that named Rudolph. And, as we say, he became the most famous reindeer of all.
My granddaughter sent my mother a Christmas card, and it came back because she put the address wrong, and it freaked her out. But I began to think, how many Christmas cards are being sent these days? I mean, some of them are electronic. But people are still sending out a lot of Christmas cards. How did that tradition start, Charles?
Well, it started in the middle 1800s in England. There was a man named Sir Henry Cole who liked to engrave pictures and on cards and send them to people. And, of course, regular mail delivery basically just started around that time. So he used to make different engravings of different scenes and send them to friends. He was basically an artist, an aristocratic artist, and he sent it to his friends. And one Christmas, around the middle 1800s, he made a nice Christmas picture and sent it to some of his friends. And then he had some cards left over, so he took them to a store in London, and they put them on sale, and they sold out, immediately. So the next year they said to him, how about giving us some more cards with Christmas pictures, Christmas drawings on it, and he did. And that started the tradition. That's where it started. In England in the middle 1800s, people, again, went to the store, bought the cards, and mailed them to their friends and family. And then the father of the U.S. Christmas card is a man named Louis Prang, who was a printer in Boston, and he printed some Christmas cards about 10 years later, 1860s, and put them on sale in Boston, and they were a big hit. And that's how the tradition of Christmas cards started. It goes back to that.
And I guess from there it probably branched out into all kinds of stuff, like Valentine's Day and everything else.
Right. Yeah, we have to realize that before that time, mail was entirely different. The receiver had to pay for the letter.
Oh, really?
Sender. Yeah. And, we didn't have regular letter carriers in those days.
How'd you like to pay for a bill you get in the mail?
That's right.
Santa Claus. How did that develop?
Santa Claus, well, you know, there really was a real St. Nicholas. He lived in the...
I just talked to him at the top of the show, by the way.
Who's St. Nicholas?
Yeah, he's out there in Manitoba right about now.
Oh, yeah, I guess he's making his rounds.
He's
anyhow, in the 4th century in what is now Turkey, and we have this story in the Old Time Book of Fascinating Facts, there really was a St. Nicholas, and he was from a very wealthy family and became well-known for giving money and gifts to people, and that tradition of doing that from his name spread basically around the world. And today, you know, Santa Claus has all different kinds of names around the world. For example, in England, he's called Father Christmas. In France, he's called Papa Noel. But it was the Dutch who, their name for St. Nicholas was Sinterklaas, which in the Dutch language means good saint. And in the 1600s, when a lot of Dutch immigrants came to the United States, they brought with them their custom of calling him Sinterklaas. And then that evolved in English from Sinterklaas into Santa Claus. And that's why we call him Santa Claus today. It's really from the Dutch Sinterklaas, which means the good saint.
We will be ending our program tonight, Charles, with one of our guests, Lionel Fanthorpe's rendition of "Twas the Night Before Christmas." He does a great job doing that. How did that start? Who composed that?
Well, that's an interesting story, too. There was a man named Clement Clark Moore, and I think, as I recall, the year was 1823, is around that time. He was a professor at a theological seminary, and he wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas. It was the night before Christmas. And he wrote it basically for the children in his family. He, as I say, was at this theological seminary, did not want to make it public, apparently, but a friend saw it. I guess one of the kids showed it around. And the friend sent it to a newspaper in Troy, New York. They published it, and it became a big hit and was picked up by other newspapers and published. And the story is that Clement Clark Moore was very embarrassed by it. Some said he denied authorship of it. He didn't acknowledge authorship of it for about 20 years. But finally, I guess he did, and he got over the embarrassment of a theological professor writing a poem like that. The interesting thing about that, and we can talk a little bit later about hanging stockings for Christmas, that helped popularize that in the United States with the lines in that poem, the stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there.
That's right.
Yeah, and that was a famous lines. And then the other thing he did in that poem was name the reindeer. These are the reindeer before Rudolph. The 8 reindeer, he popularized their names in that poem, of course. And so that one poem did a lot. And it's kind of funny that he, you know, did not want to acknowledge authorship of it for a long time.
Weren't the stockings primarily the way people gave gifts?
Well, the story is that... Because
they didn't have a lot of money in those days.
That's right.
So, you know, the kids would all have their little stockings and they put some candy in there and stuff like that.
Yeah. The way the tradition started, the folklore, is that there were 3 very poor sisters, and the original St. Nicholas, who, as I say, was famous for giving gifts and money to people, he heard about these 3 sisters. They were very poor, only had 1 pair of stockings each, and they would wash them out every night so they'd be clean for the next morning. They only had the 1 pair, as I say, each. And they used to hang the stockings by the fireplace to dry overnight. And he heard about these 3 poor sisters. So one Christmas Eve, he went to their home and put gold coins in their stockings hanging by the fireplace. And that story spread around town the next day. And the tradition spread from there. And that's how it all started.
You got to tell us about the 1800s, how that phrase, "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa," started.
That's one of the most beautiful answers George, just almost brings tears to your eyes when you hear about it. As you probably know, as most of your listeners know, there was a little girl. This is a true story. There was a little girl in New York in the 1890s. Her name was Virginia O'Hanlon. And she asked her father when near Christmas time, is there really a Santa Claus? She was like 8 years old at the time. And instead of giving her an answer, he said, well, why don't you write a letter to the New York Sun newspaper and see what they say? So she did. She sat down and wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Sun and said, you know, is there really a Santa Claus? And the editor was a man named Francis Church. That's an appropriate name. And his answer, as I say, is just so beautiful that it can bring tears to your eyes. He said, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. Thank God he lives and will continue to gladden the heart of childhood. What a beautiful answer that is.
Oh, it's a great answer. Yeah.
And by the way, she lived a long time. She didn't die until the 1970s, Virginia. And she was a school teacher. She became a school teacher as an adult in New York City. She taught the New York City public schools for about 50 years. And that's what happened to little Virginia O'Hanlon.
Just a classic. And you're right. It could bring tears to your eyes. I mean, it's just one of those beautiful little poems about life and about people, and it's everything that's good, I think, right, about Christmas.
And that's one of the most reprinted we have in our book. That's possibly the most reprinted newspaper story of all time. You know, most newspapers have printed it ever since the late 1800s. Yeah.
And in those days, I mean, that's what people did. They read the newspapers.
Oh yeah. Sure.
And I was talking to a friend of mine tonight about how newspapers are kind of waning because everybody goes online now and, you know, gets a little bit of here, a little bit of there, not in depth like the newspapers provide, but not a lot of people are reading newspapers anymore.
That's for sure. And in the old days, the afternoon newspapers were the big papers, not the morning papers. It's interesting.
That is flip-flopped, but you're right. You're right. You know, and what killed the afternoon newspapers? The immediacy of the evening news.
Exactly. You're exactly right, George.
They came in, and as an old news director, you know what that's all about.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, my son lives in Washington, D.C., and when we were down there over Thanksgiving, and we were talking about his wife grew up there in Washington, and they used to have four newspapers in Washington. And by the way, the Washington Post was the least popular newspaper.
That's right.
It survived, but there were three other newspapers there, and the big one was an afternoon paper called the Evening Star, Washington Evening Star, which is long gone out of business. But, you know, it's funny how that whole business has evolved.
It really is. Charles, when we come back, let's talk about some Christmas movies. I want to just get your thoughts on some of those, and we'll talk about some additional all-time book of fascinating facts, stories, next with Charles Richbloom. We are live for you, not on tape. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Charles Richbloom as we talk about all-time book of fascinating facts and the little Christmas stuff tossed in there for you. And then the last hour of the program, I'm going to have special Christmas Eve, Christmas morning open lines for you as well. But we'll take calls next hour with Charles Richbloom, and I've got more things to ask him about with these fascinating facts.
Hi, this is Mitch Horowitz, wishing all you revelers and Coast listeners a very Merry Christmas.
And welcome back to Coast, Charles Richbloom with us, Dr. Knowledge. Charles, let's talk about some Christmas movies and see if you have any tidbits for us. Any of them come to mind, first of all, as some of your favorites?
Yeah, there's a great story, George. This is in our book, The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. And if I may, if any of your listeners would like the book, they can see it and order it. On our website is knowledgeinanutshell.com.
One Perfect.
Word. Knowledgeinanutshell.com. You can
great book, by the way.
Read about the book, thank you, and order it there if you like. Anyhow, one of the stories I like, and we have this in the all-time book of Fascinating Facts, is the song White Christmas, which Bing Crosby's version of that has become the second best-selling record of all time.
Huge, and we just heard Pat Boone singing it.
Oh, okay. And it's amazing that that song ranks that high, because it's obviously it's only basically played around Christmas time. And yet over the years, the only recording that has surpassed it in record sales is Elton John's Candle in the Wind.
Really?
But anyhow, the story about White Christmas is very, very interesting on a lot of fronts. There was a movie called Holiday Inn in 1942, and Irving Berlin, the great songwriter, that was his concept for this movie, to have a song about each holiday. He had Be Careful, It's My Heart for Valentine's Day, obviously Easter Parade for Easter, and so on. And he needed a new song for Christmas. The idea of the movie, by the way, Holiday Inn, it was only open on holidays. People would come there and they'd have, you know, a special song for that particular holiday.
Was the hotel chain open at that time?
No, that's another story. We'll get to that.
All right, okay.
That's another part of this. Anyhow, so Irving Berlin had to write this song. He was out in California. He was a New Yorker, basically, but he was out in California at Christmas time while they were doing the movie. And he came up with the lyrics. We have in our the All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts the introduction to the song, which you never hear. And the introduction was, it's a beautiful day here. The palm trees are swaying. The sun is shining. It's a beautiful day in L.A., but, and then comes, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Actually, he was thinking about a white Christmas back in New York.
Uh-huh.
It was so sunny and nice in sunny California. So anyhow, he wrote the song for this movie, Holiday Inn. Bing Crosby was in the movie with Fred Astaire. Bing Crosby introduced the song. That's the first time it was ever heard. And then he made a recording of it after the movie, and obviously it became such a big hit that it is. That was 1942. Now, your question
about the Holiday Inns, yeah.
Interesting. There was a man named Kemmons Wilson in Memphis, Tennessee, who owned a motel in the Memphis area, and after World War II, he expanded and started building motels around all around the country, and he loved that movie. And the name of the movie was so fitting for his motels, so he named them Holiday Inn, and that's where the name Holiday Inn comes from that movie, just because that was such a favorite movie of his.
Probably was a great big boom for them in terms of attendance in room fills with that name.
That's right, for sure, yeah.
I have two favorite Christmas movies. One is the original black and white A Christmas Carol, and then, of course, It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, which is my all-time favorite. Any facts and tidbits about either one of those, Charles?
Well, they play It's a Wonderful Life. I think most TV outlets that play movies always play that around Christmas time. Another one, George, was Miracle on 34th Street.
That was fun. That was a classic.
Yeah.
That was a classic. But It's a Wonderful Life was not a box office hit.
That's right.
When it came out in the movies.
That's right. There's so many movies like that that weren't that big at the time. Casablanca is one. Singing in the Rain was not particularly successful when it first came out. You know, over the years.
I've grown to like Gene Kelly's work. God rest his soul.
He's from my hometown here in Pittsburgh, by the way, Gene Kelly.
I mean, they don't make movies like that anymore, Charles.
That's for
you know,
sure.
They don't do, you know, they don't dance around and sing, and those days are gone. Would they succeed at all if they came back? I don't know if they would.
Yeah, of course, the music today is so different. The American Film Institute ranks Singing in the Rain as the best musical of all time, best musical movie of all time. And I think, you know, it's pretty good. I think that's, sort of agree with that.
Where did the idea of giving Christmas gifts come from? Has that just always been?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to the original St. Nicholas who gave gifts. I think the custom started with that. He probably gave gifts around Christmas time to celebrate Christmas. And it's more and more, obviously more and more commercial. You know, the Puritans, the Pilgrims, were against any celebration of Christmas in that way. I mean, you know, I thought people should go to church and
stay there.
And you know, worship the birth of Jesus. And it's only really in more recent times. It's like, it's very interesting to know that, I think, I don't know if we mentioned this before in a previous show with you or not, but Christmas trees, for example, George Washington never had a Christmas tree in his home, and virtually nobody else in America in the early days of the nation had Christmas trees. This is really an interesting fact.
Huh.
And it happens to be in the all-time book of fascinating facts. It was the Germans who started the tradition of decorating trees at Christmas time, and it started outside. They used to decorate the trees.
Right, and
outside.
They're pretty with a little white snow. They're gorgeous, aren't they?
Exactly. And then in the middle, roughly the middle 1800s, they began to bring their trees inside at Christmas time. And a whole lot of German immigrants came to this country in the middle 1800s and beyond, and brought with them their custom of having a Christmas tree in a home. And that's where the tradition started. And then Queen Victoria of England married Prince Albert of Germany, and he brought with him the custom of the Christmas tree. And they had this big Christmas tree in the palace in London, and that picture went worldwide and was particularly seen here in America, and that really helped begin the popularity of having Christmas trees in homes. But it is interesting that, as I say, George Washington certainly never had a Christmas tree in his house. Thomas Jefferson never had one, because the early America, it just wasn't a custom then. And, you know, as widespread and popular as that custom is today, it's so surprising to learn that it didn't exist until, in this country, until really the middle 1800s and beyond. And I think the same thing is true of Christmas gifts. And it really wasn't a national holiday until the 1880s. Very few states made it a holiday.
It was more religious, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was meant to be religious and not, way we celebrate it today. But I'm glad we do.
Oh, me too. The retailers are glad we do, too.
Yeah, for sure. And it makes it more joyous, I think. You know.
What about the food? Any facts or tidbits about that? Because most families will eat tomorrow ham or turkey.
Yeah. We have the fact that the two biggest eating days of the year, the 2 days that Americans eat the most food, originally it was obviously Thanksgiving as number one, but Christmas used to be number two. But Christmas has now been surpassed by Super Bowl Sunday.
Really?
That's now the second biggest eating day in America, and that's also the biggest pizza eating day.
Pizza and chili, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of pizzas, how did that happen?
Well, that's interesting, too, and it's hard to believe that if you lived in the 1920s, 1930s, you would not have picked up the phone and ordered a pizza. You would not have gone to a pizza shop.
And it definitely wouldn't have been delivered.
That's right.
No Domino's in those days, huh?
That's for sure. Most people, the only pizza available in the country in those days was in some Italian neighborhoods in big cities, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, had pizza shops, but just basically in Italian neighborhoods. And for most of America, there was no pizza. Most people didn't even know what pizza was throughout most of the country. And then in World War II, the returning service men and women who had served in Italy brought with them their desire to have pizza here. There were two brothers in Wichita, Kansas, who borrowed, they didn't have much money themselves, they borrowed $800 from their mother to open the first pizza store. It was called Pizza Hut, and the only reason they chose that name was it was a very small doorway, a very small entrance.
Now, was that the beginning of the Pizza Hut?
Yeah, and they didn't have room for a big name, so they made it about as short as you could, Pizza Hut, and that was the start of that chain. And that was, again, after World War II. That was about 1948. And then, of course, pizza, the demand, desire for pizza began to spread around the country. Yeah. But as I say, if you lived in, let's say, 1935, you would not have ordered pizza or gone to a pizza shop.
Well, in Detroit, the little Caesars pizza started, and the Illich family started to franchise them.
That's
and
right.
they made so much money, Charles, he went on, and Mitch Illich, he went on to buy the Detroit Tigers and the Red Wings, the hockey team.
You're absolutely right.
From pizzas.
Yep.
It's crazy.
Well, it's become, as I say, on Super Bowl Sunday, just think how much pizza is eaten.
Oh, my God, yeah. Those places must just deliver like crazy.
Absolutely.
They're crazy. Dr. Knowledge with us. His website, of course, is called knowledgeinanutshell.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, where you can get his books. And they're great books to have, especially if you have like a party or something and you want to play some trivia games with people. They're really something else. Let's talk about a few little effects, Charles, beyond Christmas, and then we'll take calls next hour with you about just about anything. But you have collected like every strange thing, and you said that it's hard to believe, but the Super Bowl owes its name to an 8-year-old girl talking about the Super Bowl. How did that happen?
How about that? Originally, there was the National Football League, and then a competing league started in 1960 called the American Football League. They were competitors of the National
Football League.
And there was a real demand for players, and prices went up for players. The owners didn't like that because the American Football League were making offers to some kids as they were coming out of school. The National Football League was trying to get those players. There was a real competition for players, which drove the price up for salaries. So finally, in the middle of the 1960s, the owners in the National Football League had enough of that, so they had merger talks with the American Football League. One of the owners of the team in the American Football League was Lamar Hunt.
Remember his name.
Right.
Was it a Kansas City team?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, his family still, he died just a few years ago, Lamar Hunt. So anyhow, he was one of the people who worked out the merger between the competing leagues, the American Football League and National Football League, giving us today's American Football Conference and National Football Conference. So anyhow, in the middle 1960s, the leagues merged and they were deciding what to call their championship game. Up till that time, the championship game in the NFL was simply called the National Football League Championship Game. You know, not a very catchy name, but that's what it was. So anyhow, Lamar Hunt, being one of the keynote people in the merger, was on the committee to come up with a name for the championship game. At the end of the season, they would have the champion of the American Football Conference play the leader
in the National Football Conference
we do today. So anyhow, there was a conference call. He was at home in his living room in Kansas City and was talking with some other owners. There were about six owners on the line, and they were discussing different possibilities of what they could call their championship game. Meantime, his daughter, 8-year-old Sharon Hunt, is on the floor in the living room listening to her dad talking on the phone, and she's playing with one of the most popular toys at that time. I don't know how many of your listeners might remember this. There was a toy called the Super Ball. It was a real hard black rubber ball that bounced
like crazy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And she was playing with that on the living room floor, hearing her dad talk about different names they could call the championship game, and she very innocently looked up to her dad and said, "Why don't you call it the Super Bowl?" So it's a true story.
These kids and their names.
It's a true story. So anyhow, he said, "Oh, my daughter just said, how about Super Bowl?" And the other owners, there was silence, I think, for a moment, and then
they loved it.
That's not a bad idea. And anyhow, that no question, that's how the name came to be, and it was all this 8-year-old girl. Now, I had written that story in one of my previous books, and I was involved in forming World Team Tennis, the World Team Tennis League, and Lamar Hunt was very active, not only in football, but he also had a soccer team, and he also had a tennis tour, and he was interested in our league. And
hold on for a second, Charles. I'll let you finish that story when we come back. Plus, we'll take calls with Charles Richbloom next on Coast to Coast AM.